Okay, these are the passages that discuss how the practice of mindfulness and the practice of jhana come together. We've already done passage 9 with the beauty queen. Passage 10. Now, what is concentration? What qualities are its themes? What qualities are its requisites? And what is its development? And this is Sister Damodina. This is a dialogue. The man, Visakha, is talking to his former wife, who is now a nun. And she's telling him, she's answering his questions. She says, singleness of mind is concentration. The four establishings of mindfulness are its themes. This is one of the passages where it connects mindfulness practice and concentration practice. When you talk about the theme of concentration, you're talking about, okay, what is the object? And the object of the concentration here can be any one of those four themes in the body, feelings, mind, or mental qualities. The four right exertions are its requisites. This is what you need to work with to support right concentration. And then developing any of these qualities is its development of concentration. So basically, you're working on right exertion and the establishing of mind must again give rise to concentration. The right exertion is the four right efforts, which is to prevent unskillful qualities from arising, to get rid of, abandon unskillful qualities that have arisen, to give rise to skillful qualities that have not yet arisen, and then to maintain and develop the ones that have. So those are the four right exertions. The next passage talks about another way in which right concentration is connected with mindfulness. He starts out, what is noble right concentration with its supports and requisite conditions? Any singleness of mind equipped with these seven factors, and it goes through the other seven factors of the path, is called right noble right concentration with its support and requisite conditions. Now of those, right review is the forerunner. And how is right view the forerunner? One discerns wrong view and right view is right view. Okay. Then one makes an effort. Okay. He actually goes on and explains that. I cut it out because I was focusing on something else. One makes an effort for the abandoning of wrong view and for entering into right view. This is one's right effort. One is mindful to abandon wrong view and to remain in right view. This is one's right mindfulness. So again, mindfulness here is not just noting things, it's actually keeping in mind the fact that you've got to abandon unskillful qualities and develop skillful ones. And so a right view, right effort, and right mindfulness run and circle around right view and each of the remaining path factors all the way up to support right concentration. So in this case, they're talking about how the mindfulness to develop what is skillful and abandon what is unskillful is one of the requisite factors for right concentration. So again, they go together. It's this combination of mindfulness and effort working together. You see this again and again. The Buddha never has you do one without the other. Do you have a question about right view and wrong view over there? Okay. I don't have the full passage memorized, but basically the Buddha is saying the wrong view consists of believing that you're not responsible for your actions or your actions have no result. And it goes on to the way the Buddha frames this, he says basically that there is such a thing as generosity. He starts out with that, which sounds obvious, there is generosity, but apparently that was a controversial topic at the time, because the Brahmins had been saying for centuries and centuries that generosity bears great fruit when it's given to the Brahmins. Now you can imagine after a couple of centuries of that, people get kind of tired of the message, you know. And so there are other people came on to say that generosity bears no fruit at all, it's just a bunch of Brahmins trying to sell you a bill of goods. And so their way of justifying that view was saying either everything is determined, but everything you're going to do has already been determined, so you have no choices. Therefore, there is no virtue in generosity. Now, if I'm being generous with you, there's some outside forces causing this to happen, so I'm not responsible. So there's no virtue. Either that, or as the people you're giving to are going to die, and there's going to be nothing left, so there's nothing gained by being generous to anybody. So when the Buddha says there is generosity, he's basically saying no to both of those ideas. On the one hand, you do have choices and there is something of lasting value to each person. And then from there he goes into the discussion of karma and rebirth. So what he calls mundane right view is basically seeing things in terms of, okay, you do have responsibility for your actions, they do have results, and there is a life after this one. That's mundane right view. Then transcendent right view is seeing things in terms of the Four Noble Truths. Okay. And the teaching on karma is not just a cultural relic from the time of the Buddha, because there was a lot of controversy about that issue as well when he was alive. But if you see it in terms of mindfulness, of being mindful about what you're going to be doing, you see how the two teachings connect. You're constantly acting, so you've got to keep in mind, okay, what is the right way to act? How do I look at this particular situation? So I respond in a skillful way. Okay, now we're going to go down the standard discussion of the four jhanas. Hope one of these works. Okay. The Buddha talks about four jhanas. The word jhana is related to a verb to burn, jayati. And Pali language has several verbs for burning, and the verb that's used for oil lamps, steady flame, that's jayati. So this is the quality you're trying to develop in the mind, it's this kind of steady flame kind of quality. And there are four levels that he discusses. On top of the four levels, there are four formless attainments that can be attained, because they're not necessarily part of the path. I didn't include them this time. Okay, quite secluded from sensuality, secluded from unskillful qualities. You enter and remain in the first jhana, rapture and pleasure born of seclusion, accompanied by directed thought and evaluation. Now notice the description here does not tell which topic you're on. It could be any one of the four frames of reference, but for the sake of discussion, let's take the body. Okay. To be secluded from sensuality means that you're not thinking sensual thoughts. Sometimes you'll see this translated as secluded from sensual pleasures, but that's not what the Buddha is talking about. Sensuality is this quality of the mind's fascination with thinking about sensual things. So you put that aside. With secluded from unskillful qualities, this would be any of the other wrong factors of the path. You enter and remain in the first jhana, rapture and pleasure born of seclusion. Just the simple fact that you've put these unskillful things away, there is a measure of ease and a measure of rapture. Rapture here can also be translated as refreshment. It feels refreshed sitting there. For some people, it's a very mild quality. For other people, it can be very strong. Some people feel like they're drowning. And sometimes, you know, your hair can stand on end, a chill can run through your body. Or it's just a strong sense of fullness throughout the body, that you're not feeling any hunger of any kind at all. Pleasure here can be ease, also translated as ease, or just a general sense of well-being. Accompanied by directed thought and evaluation. Now, directed thought is when you focus your thoughts on a particular topic, and evaluation is what you tell yourself about that topic. So at this stage, you're still talking to yourself a little bit, giving yourself instructions. And what are you talking about? You're talking about your breath. And what are you evaluating? You're going to evaluate, is the breath comfortable? Is the breath not comfortable? If it's not comfortable, what can I do to make it comfortable? Try things out. Is the mind staying with the breath? Is the mind not staying with the breath? This is the analogy of the cook, basically looking at what's working and what's not working. When you've got something that works, the breath feels good, then the next question is, how do I not fall asleep? So then you evaluate, how do I spread, and we'll be getting to this in a minute, you spread the pleasure throughout the body at the same time that you expand your awareness to fill the body as well. So it goes on. You permeate and pervade, suffuse, and fill this very body with a rapture and pleasure born of seclusion. Just as if a skilled bathman or bathman's apprentice would pour bath powder into a brass basin and knead it together, sprinkling it again and again with water, so that his ball of bath powder, saturated, moisture-laden, permeated within and without, would nevertheless not drip. Even so, you permeate this very body with a rapture and pleasure born of seclusion. There is nothing of your entire body unpervaded by pleasure, rapture and pleasure born of seclusion. And as you remain thus heedful, ardent, and resolute, any memories and resolves related to the household life are abandoned. And with abandoning, your mind gathers and centers inwardly, grows unified and centered. This is how you develop mindfulness of rest in the body. Okay, that's the first jhana. Sound good? Okay. Now, I want you to notice these analogies as we go through. This one here with the bathman and his apprentice, this is the only one of the analogies for these four jhanas where there's a conscious agent. There's someone who's consciously basically kneading the rapture and pleasure through the body. This takes, like as we're going through the body this morning, you're going to work through any patterns of tension, let them dissolve, keep them from forming up again. That's the bathman walking through, going through your body. Yeah. Okay, once the mind is settled down and doesn't really need to keep evaluating the breath anymore, then with the stilling of directed thoughts and evaluations, you enter and remain in the second jhana, rapture and pleasure born of concentration. Okay, now the rapture and pleasure come from a new source. It's not just the fact that you've dropped the disturbances of sensual thinking, but you actually got the mind concentrated and centered, and there's a sense of rapture that comes from that. Unification of awareness, basically this is the point where you feel like you become one with the breath. Your awareness and the breath seem to be the same thing. Free from directed thought and evaluation, internal assurance. You permeate and pervade, suffuse, and fill this very body with rapture and pleasure born of concentration. Just like a lake with spring water welling up from within, having no inflow from the east, west, north, or south, and with the skies supplying abundant showers time and again, so that the cool fount of water welling up from within the lake would permeate and pervade, suffuse, and fill it with cool waters, there being no part of the lake unpervaded by the cool waters. In the same way, you permeate this very body with a rapture and pleasure born of concentration, and thus your mind gathers and settles inwardly, grows unified and centered. Okay, this is the point, as I said, where the breath feels really good, and you decide, this is good enough, I can settle in. And there's a sense of, when you're working with the first jhana and you're adjusting the breath, it's like you're here and the breath is there, and now you're kind of getting into the breath and feeling surrounded by it, and your awareness and the breath have become one. And there's a sense of energy filling the body that comes about as a result. Now there comes a point when the sense of, and notice here in the analogy, you've got water and you've got movement, and the movement of the water coming up through the lake, but there is no conscious agent, it's just happening on its own now. Yeah. Then with the fading of rapture, remain equanimous, mindful, and alert, and sense pleasure with the body. You enter and remain in the third jhana, of which the noble ones declare equanimous and mindful, you have a pleasant abiding. You permeate and pervade, suffuse, and fill this very body with the pleasure divested of rapture. Just as in a lotus pond, some of the lotuses born and growing in the water stay immersed in the water and flourish without standing up out of the water, so they are permeated and pervaded, suffused, and filled with cool water from their roots to their tips. And nothing of those lotuses would be unpervaded with the cool water. So now you still have water, but there's no more movement. So basically the movement here stands for rapture. Cool water stands for pleasure. And in the first one, the bathman or his apprentice stands for directed thought and evaluation. Now, they said that there's both pleasure and equanimity here in this third jhana. The equanimity is basically a quality of the mind, and the pleasure is something you sense of the body. The body feels really good. And the mind is equanimous. And for the fourth jhana, with the abandoning of pleasure and pain, as with the earlier disappearance of elation and distress, there's some question about, you know, why you're waiting until the fourth jhana to abandon pain. But there's a passage in the canon where, again, Sister Damodina is talking to her ex-husband, and she says, you know, the two pleasure and, well, she doesn't say you know, but she says, pleasure and pain contain each other. Pain, when it changes, is pleasant. Pleasure, when it changes, is painful. And so you're not going to get rid of either until you've dropped both. So even though you've been working with the pleasure, there's still an element of pain mixed up with that pleasure, the fact that it's changeable. But when you're able to drop that, okay, you've abandoned pleasure and pain. You enter and remain in the fourth jhana, purity of equanimity and mindfulness. This is the point where mindfulness actually becomes pure. Up to this point, it's not fully pure. It's because it's now coupled with pure equanimity. You sit permeating the body with a pure, bright awareness, just as if a man were sitting covered from head to foot in a white cloth, so there'd be no part of his body to which the white cloth did not extend. Even so, the monk sits pervading the body with a pure, bright awareness. There's nothing of your entire body unpervaded by a pure, bright awareness. And as you remain thus heedful, ardent, and resolute, your mind gathers and settles inwardly, grows unified and centered. This is how you develop mindfulness immersed in the body. So those are the descriptions of the four jhanas, and it's kind of the standard analogies for them. And you have to see these analogies are quite precise. The water stands for pleasure. Movement stands for rapture. As I said, the bathman and his apprentice stand for directed thought and evaluation. And when you're getting to a progressively more refined, unified focus as you go through here. So when they talk about, say, the first jhana having five factors, you've got pleasure, rapture, directed thought, evaluation, and singleness of preoccupation. Now, it's not like you have five separate things that you're trying to mix together. You've got the singleness of preoccupation and these other things accompany it. You're with the one object, but there's also these other things there as well. And John Lee makes a couple of useful observations here. One is that of these factors, the directed thought and the evaluation and the singleness, those are the causes. The pleasure and the rapture come about as a result. It's not like you're going to grab pleasure from someplace and throw it in and grab rapture from someplace else and throw it in. You've got the sense of you're with the object and it's getting you interested, which is why you're talking to yourself about it. You're analyzing it, working with it. One way I found to get really interested in the breath is to, if you have a certain part of the body where you have a chronic pain, you can ask yourself, how is the way I'm breathing affecting the pain? Is there a way I can breathe in another way that's actually going to help soothe the pain or work through it? And after a while, you find yourself really interested in this because you can begin to see the results right away. But that's what the directed thought and evaluation do, is they try to get you interested in the object the same way that you're trying to get a fit between the object and the mind so they come together and can stay together. Any questions on this before we break?
Mm-hmm. As you say, an actual dialogue with myself. And yet I feel like I want to resist those words. Mm-hmm. But it sounds like you're suggesting that might be unskillful. I should perhaps
learn how to use them. Learn how to use them.
At the beginning.
Right. And again, it's not kind of a big discursive dialogue. It's just saying, how's it going? How's it going? How's it going? Fine, fine, not so fine. Okay, not so fine, what's wrong? And then you can get more engaged.
And as concentration increases,
it gets less necessary.
Less necessary.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that it would, for most people, for me, most importantly? Mm-hmm.
As long as there's something to talk about, you'll find something to talk about. Which means there comes a point where you have to say, you know, this is good enough. I can just kind of plunge in. And the part of your mind that likes to have control over things by talking about them will resist. And it'll keep coming out saying, this is dumb. You're not thinking about anything. And this is where you have to say, I don't care. This is a skill. I've got to learn how to be skillful about not talking to myself. But also you can't turn it off too early, in the sense that if the breath is really not comfortable, it's like trying to lie down in a bed and there's just lots of stuff under the mattress, and you can stay there, but it's not going to be comfortable. So you get basically with the direct thought and evaluation, you're opening up and getting the crap out of from under the mattress and then putting it down.
So as long as it feels skillful.
And you can see it's getting results. Yes.
I've read and heard Ayakema talk about when you're working with this and you're in the early stages of it, to kind of go with it, but then immediately, you know, after you sort of realize it's over, try and remember how you got there.
Well, this is a different step in the practice when you're trying to get into concentration and you don't want to have too many analytical things going on. You're just analyzing the breath, and then you finally settle down. When you've come out, ask yourself, okay, what did I do? Can I remember the steps? And when things begin to gather together, where was I focused? What was the quality of the breath? What led up to that? Whatever. Every meditation session, you ask yourself, when you came out, when was the best point in the meditation? And then, okay, where was I focused? What was I doing? And then the next time you meditate, can I go there right away? And sometimes you can, and sometimes you can't. But at least it gives you pointers for, okay, this is how I'm going to make this into a skill. You're skipping down. Yes. Okay. No, awareness release basically is, there are two kinds of release. There's awareness release and there's discernment release. Awareness release is when the mind is put aside passion. Discernment release is when it's put aside ignorance. And generally, the awareness release can either be just plain old concentration, or it can be one of the noble states as well. Whereas discernment release is always a noble state. So when you're getting the mind really still, you have temporarily released yourself from sensual thoughts, ill will, all these other things. Now, it doesn't mean you've permanently got through them. But for the time that you're in that state, you're released from them.
I have been thinking of an awareness release as the exercise of letting a thought or something go as it emerges.
Okay, that's one of the things you do in concentration is to let these emerging thoughts go. But the actual state of being in concentration, that's the awareness release. Because you're at that point, you're not under the power of unskillful thinking. But you're not released for forever. It's like being let out of the prison for a short period of time. What do they call that? What's the legal term for that?
Day pass.
It's like a day pass. Okay, now I got a new phrase. Okay, great. Day pass, yeah. And discernment is when you're out and you don't have to pay parole. There's nothing. You're out for, you know. Okay. Yes.
It talks about the last line of this is how one develops mindfulness immersed in the body. Mm-hmm.
They're partners in this, yeah. Mm-hmm. Right. Well, again, and here, mindfulness immersed in the body. This concentration is the full mindfulness immersed in the body. This is taken from a sutta where he starts out with the regular descriptions of the, you know, mindfulness, establishing mindfulness, and then he goes into the jhanas as kind of the next step right up. So they go together. Yes.
By your opinion, was it determined, or was just a coincidence that you became a monk, a teacher? Mm-hmm. And my second question is, have you ever meditated on your previous life experiences?
Who? I think it wasn't a coincidence. I think the Buddha had this plan for a long time. Because you don't build that kind of perfection without taking a lot of time and taking a lot of effort and determination to go into it. As for my previous lifetimes, every now and then you have a little something that comes up, but you don't know for sure whether it's true or not. So you just kind of say, oh, that's interesting, and you leave it. Because I have seen some people who do take it too seriously, and it gets kind of bad. My teacher had one student who, after he died, she had a vision of herself having been a queen in a previous lifetime. And she used to dress very plainly. And now all of a sudden it rings, a little bit of makeup, just kind of replaying her old days. And it was not a good thing. There was another case I knew of a monk and a nun who were meditating in the same monastery. And the nun started having visions that this monk had been her husband in a previous lifetime, and he started having visions that she had been his wife in a previous lifetime. So they compared notes. Disrobed. And decided to pick up where they left off. And it may have been a happy marriage the last time, but it wasn't this time. They were separated 8 times, had 8 children, 1 per separation. And then when I saw her, she was a really miserable-looking woman. It was really sad. So you can't take these things too seriously, or you shouldn't take them too seriously. Most of the little visions I had to do with being very, very poor. And I would mention these occasionally to my teacher, and he'd say, oh, this is why you decided you wanted to get out. I had one where I was an untouchable in India, and I had this job of cleaning up all the old dead flowers and stuff around shrines. And I found out later this actually is a job for the untouchables in India. And at the end of the day, I would get a handful of grain from my boss. And I'd take it home to my wife. And we lived in this tiny little grass shack. And in the vision, we had shelves in the grass shack and their children lining the shelves, all crying because they were very hungry. And so I give the handful of grain to my wife for the meal that night. She said, this is not enough. And this pain came to my chest, but I've been working all day and this is all I can get. And then I came out of the vision. I said, whoa. So it was a pretty heavy vision, yeah. Okay. Any other questions on concentration? Yes. Mm-hmm.
Just a quick one around intensity. Mm-hmm. When sensual, if I may use the word temptations, mm-hmm. You've been a really good boy for a long time, mm-hmm.
Okay, the first thing you've got to do is chop up the enemy so it doesn't seem so strong. And part of the way the enemy gets strong is say, I'm this wave that's building and building and building, and if you don't do something about me, I'm just going to crash the wall down. And you have to say, okay, I'm putting this together as a wave. I don't have to perceive it as a wave. Learn how to see that these things come and go, come and go, come and go. And you don't have to add strength from the past. Because usually it doesn't come all of a sudden. There's a little blip here, a little blip there, and then the blips get more and more frequent because you've let your guard down. And so you have to be careful about the little blips. And see, they are little blips, and you can see between them. Between the blips, you're okay. And so the first line of defense is the opposite of what I told that man back there. Okay, if you don't believe in the wave, it's not going to be a wave. The first thing. And then the second thing is you've got to say, okay, the real appeal here is not so much the object, it's just the energy that comes with the desire. Why don't I focus that energy into the practice and get a sense of pleasure that comes out of the concentration instead? And this is where you can work on patterns of tension in the back of the hand, palm, at the tops of your feet, wherever you tend to feel the tension beginning to build from. Okay, work on feeding that with lots of good breath energy. So there's a sense of fullness there. It takes a lot of the power out of the desire. Because it is a craving for a certain kind of energy and a certain kind of pleasure. Say, okay, here's some energy, here's some pleasure. You're not so hungry anymore. Yes. Well, getting stuck on jhana is a lot better than getting stuck on sensuality, which is where people tend to get stuck if they're not stuck on jhana. And it's relatively, and again, there's wrong concentration, and a lot of that when you're really kind of blanking out, which is what not we're teaching here. We're teaching full body awareness, full alertness while you're doing this. It is a possibility, but it's not as dangerous as they make it out to be. No, it's not. I mean, people kill and steal over sensual desire. They have illicit sex, they lie, they do all these horrible things. People do not kill over jhana. That's what it comes down to. Okay, let's stop for a bit.